Friday Night Wine Fight contains coarse language and adult themes. Listener discretion is strongly advised.
Hey guys, Amy here. I just wanted to let you all know that we have set up a Buy Me a Coffee account. What is Buy Me a Coffee, you ask? Well, it's a platform where you can donate as little as the cost of a coffee to our podcast. Your donation will go towards the running costs of this podcast. Our goal is to reach $480, which is the yearly cost of our platform host, Buzzsprout. You can find the link to our Buy Me a Coffee page on our socials, Twitter, Tumblr, Facebook, and Instagram, or at our blog, which is www.fridaynightwinefight.blogspot.com or at www.buymeacoffee.com/FNWF podcast. Thanks so much for listening. Now on with the show.
Welcome to Friday Night Wine Fight.
I'm Sarah.
I'm Amy.
And I'm Bianca. We are three Melbourne girls who had nothing better to do than start this damn podcast while we're all living the damn lockdown. And, well, we've been doing it ever since.
You didn't read the line, mate.
This is lockdown. No. What? You've written something different?
I have.
Oh, lockdown hokey pokey. Oh, well, I can't say that because you're wrong. It's not hokey pokey. It's hokey tokey.
What?
Yeah. Hokey pokey is food.
Oh, for fuck's sake. Let's continue. The line's stupid anyway.
Ah!
Sorry, I'm from New Zealand and we don't say hokey pokey. Say hokey tokey. There you go.
Fucking New Zealanders. Anyway. We love New Zealand, but
I thought I was being clever.
No, no, it's just Australians, Americans.
We're too dumb to be clever. Let's continue.
Thank you. So
we take aim at one topic, well, sometimes many topics each week, with the main topic and a tangent thrown in over a bottle of wine. Hey, lady, how are you doing tonight?
Well, I'm drinking one of my old favorites, Brown Browns, Moscato and Pinot Grigio. Grigio? Anyway, I'm drinking that tonight.
Still got your girly drink with some awesome Pinot Grigio in it.
Yeah. I am drinking a new one because it got thrown in as one of my free bottles from my Wine Pyramids game. And it's called A&R Genteel, and it's by the Fun Folks who make some of my favorite wines from Boy Meets Girl Winery. And the Genteel is an interesting one. It's a white blend. So it's a bit of mix of fucking everything. And it's taking me a little while to really get into the swing of this. It's just, I don't know, it's got a heaviness to it and it's got quite a heavy flavor on the end of the sip, and it's taking me a little while. So I will probably get halfway through this episode and I'll be trashed because I've just decided to scull it.
Oh, that's how I usually play.
Yeah.
Does A&R stands for arts and rants? Because I feel like that's a topic. But gentle. Yes.
Arts gentle. And rants.
Gentle. Yeah.
Gentle.
Well, I'm drinking Choosy Beggars Cab Merlot. Yep. Which I had to find the Merlot myself in the damn store. That's all I was looking for was Merlot. Poor boy. Had no fucking clue. Yeah, well, I showed him where his Merlots were, tucked away next to the cabs, and then I ended up with a cab Merlot because I kept talking to him.
And he didn't have anything useful to say.
Yeah. So, yes, Choosy Beggar sounded great.
Sounded accurate.
Yeah, yeah. So, Sarah, tell us, what is our topic tonight?
Well, I will say I got all my information from WebMD in regards to our topic. So our topic tonight, so yeah, if it's wrong, I don't give a fuck. I'm tired.
Yeah. Oh, no, so no.
Our topic for tonight is Stockholm Syndrome.
That's the one that you'd written, that you got all your info from WebMD. I'm like, yeah. She fucking diagnosed Stockholm Syndrome. Like, yeah, I feel a bit close to my captors. Just Googled that. WebMD came up. Dr. Google, you have cancer and Stockholm syndrome.
Yeah. Yeah, well, by the end of it, yeah, I'm thinking maybe I've got cancer and I've got like 3 days to live.
Yeah.
That was 3 days ago, people.
Yeah, you're fine.
I'm about to die. It's okay. I'll be gone by the end of the episode. So, what is Stockholm syndrome? Well, it's not a psychological diagnosis, but a way of understanding the emotional response that some people have towards captors or abusers. I thought it was, you know.
I thought it was a thing.
I thought it was a thing. Well, it is a thing, but it's not a thing.
Not really recognized as a thing.
Yeah. So people who are subject to abuse or held captives.
I've held captives.
Yeah. Held captive, not the other way around, can have feelings of sympathy or other positive feelings towards their captors. This happens over days, weeks, months, or years of captivity or close contact with the captors. Some of the feelings someone who has Stockholm syndrome may feel towards their captors or abusers include love, sympathy, empathy, and a desire to protect them, which, well, hey, sometimes I can understand that, but, you know.
That's how you feel about me sometimes, but most of the time you just hate me, so.
Yeah, I just fucking hate you. That's the majority of the time. So developing a bond between a captive and a captor can lead to a kinder treatment and less harm from the abuser. The captor may also create a positive bond towards their victim. So it may work in, you know, your favor to be a little bit crazy towards your captor.
Yeah, they actually say that when they talk about hostage situations to treat your captors as much as you can. Try not to show them that you're scared of them and try and just treat them like you'd treat anybody else because it's humanizing.
Yeah. And give them a little bit of sympathy. Maybe that's what they need. I understand what you're going through. Yes. Don't kill me.
You know what this hostage situation needs? Beers. I feel like if we had beers, we'd all be like in a better mood.
Dude, you need a beer. You're stressed. Oh,
and pizza. Right. Someone needs to go on a pizza run.
Actually, you know, we can make those dumb fuck cops out the front get it for us. Yeah, let's do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's make them go on the beer run. Good idea.
Well, Stockholm syndrome might also have the hostages have negative feelings towards anyone who might try to, like, help them or, like, attempt to save them. So, like, the police.
Especially when you're halfway through your pizza and beers. I feel like that's just annoying.
Fuck them. So, people have more than likely been suffering from Stockholm syndrome for decades, but it was first named in 1973 by a guy whose name is written here, but I don't know if I'm going to pronounce it right. Niels Bergot? Bergot?
Bergot?
Bergot?
I don't know.
I don't fucking know.
Bergerot?
Niels Bergerot? I don't know. Swedish. But he's a criminologist in Stockholm, Sweden.
That guy.
So, yeah. And he used the term to explain the unexpected reaction hostages of a bank raid had towards their captors.
Yeah.
So despite being held against their will in a life-threatening situation, these people developed a positive relationship with their captors and even helped them pay for their lawyers after they were caught and refused to testify against them.
I don't know. How bizarre is it?
Yep. It's like, yeah. Oh, yes, they held us captive. Oh, but we're not testifying. Oh, yeah. Also, we're raising money for their lawyers. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, fucking hell. Yeah. So and clearly,
like, isn't there also like it's not just Stockholm syndrome. It's also like
Nuremberg syndrome.
There's like Norway syndrome or something like that. There's a couple other syndromes because it's named after the experience in that place.
That's
called Stockholm syndrome because it was, you know, this thing happened in Stockholm. So
I'm thinking of the, I think it's the Nuremberg defense where the Nazis said, well, we were just doing what we were told. Yeah, that's different.
Oh, yeah, that's different.
Yeah. I didn't really go too far into it.
You didn't go fuzzy tail.
No. Because I do all my research while I'm at work, so I don't have time. But, yeah, not all people who are in these kind of situations do experience Stockholm Syndrome, and it's not clear why some react in this way. But it is thought to be a survival mechanism. So people might create these bonds as a way to cope with extreme fear and stress that they're feeling at the time. So some key pieces. By the way, a lot of this I did copy and paste. So it's the first time I'm reading this.
Strap in, people.
Yeah. Because, again, who's got time?
I do prefer when you dictate in. It's much more like
much more entertaining for you guys.
Yeah. not that it's much more interesting. That was a very bad choice of words. No, this is interesting. It's just more funny.
That's more interesting. Put it out there.
Anyway, so some key pieces seem to increase the likelihood of Stockholm Syndrome, including being in an emotionally charged situation for a long time, mm-hmm. being in a shared space with the hostage taker with poor conditions, so not enough food, physically uncomfortable spaces, when hostages are dependent on the hostage taker for basic needs, when threats to life are not carried out, so like a mock execution. It's like, okay. People who might have been abused or severely threatened by a captor or an abuser, but they are also, but they also rely on them for their survival. Because
mm-hmm.
you don't know, if you're in this situation, you don't know at any point these people could fucking turn around and go, okay, well, we are going to kill you now.
It's just like when I organize walkabout. Yeah, you're dependent on me because I know like what's been booked. But yeah, uncomfortable, small situations, barely any food. I've dehumanized everybody who's in my presence.
You're the one with the crumpets and the toaster, so we have to check in with you in the morning.
And I have the tickets and I have the extra room keys in case somebody gets lost.
Yeah, and you're holding everyone's shit.
Yeah.
I feel like
that's more so you don't get lost because someone will come find you.
Oh, someone will definitely not come find me. If I've got all the things on me, someone will definitely come get me. Yeah. But otherwise, I'm lost.
No, exactly. For your self-preservation.
That's how I make Amy friends, syndrome. People.
Sorry, I don't have cunt syndrome. I'm okay.
Anyway, I've pretty much lost where I was. If the abuser is kind in any way, the victim might kind of cling to this as a coping mechanism for survival. They might have sympathy towards them for this kindness. There isn't much research apparently on Stockholm Syndrome. I don't know if that's true. I'm pretty sure there should be a fair amount. It's
technically a thing. Yeah. They don't have a lot of like scientific evidence. They've just got sort of anecdotal stuff from science people.
It would be hard to set up as a testing environment too. Like, you can't really inflict abuse on people.
I don't know. Amy does that with us pretty well.
Ethical reasons.
I could probably write a really good paper about Stockholm Syndrome, and that's just about my friendship with you guys. So,
yeah.
But I'm the abuser. I probably should write a paper.
Yeah. And then they'd have to study Sarah and my brain. Yeah.
Yeah, good luck with that.
Yeah, because I have several other undiagnosed traumas to deal with. So pick one.
I'm the least of her problems. Let's put it out there.
Yeah.
So people that, like, types of Stockholm Syndrome, child abuse can lead to Stockholm Syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
Sports ball or any sport can lead to Stockholm Syndrome. You know, with overbearing coaches and such.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I got a question now. First I was going like, what? Like, therapy for your team, is that like, do you get brainwashed? Is that like what happens?
Yes, that's exactly what happens. Okay. You join a sport and then they brainwash you into thinking this is great. Like gymnastics, you hear so often that like gymnastics coaches, they're fucking horrible and abusive. And they're like, oh no, my coach is so great. But they kind of beat me at the same time.
Yeah. Don't let you eat and all sorts of stuff.
All the good goodness tend to be from countries where it might just be okay to beat the shit out of sports people.
Yeah. And you just, especially like those poor gymnastics girls, like, oh my God. And like bouncing around, you look at them like, you're 7. I'm 23. Fuck off. You're not 23. How?
Oh, yes, the Russians.
I wasn't going there, but okay.
Oh, no, I'll point fingers. It's fine. So abuse, even domestic abuse, sexual abuse, a lot of people in abusive relationships, the victim will develop Stockholm syndrome. It's like, oh, no, it's my fault that he does this, or it's my fault she does that, that kind of thing. And sex trafficking.
Okay.
Sex traffickers, well, yeah, these poor women, they're going to cling to whoever is nice to them, even though they're really kind of fucking screwing with them.
However, sex trafficking is an interesting one. It's just because, like, when you think about it, often what happens is that, you know, well, it doesn't have to be women. Men are sold into sex trafficking as well. The person who handles them and moves them around, they're the ones that the victim usually depends on for all their basic needs, so food, water, shelter, and all that sort of stuff. Often that person, the first line handler, they're not some billionaire or something like that. They're just as poor as these other people. They're in just about a situation. They're just trying to survive. So you could kind of understand from the victim's point of view that anybody who comes in contact with them, they're just in a shit situation too. You kind of humanize it that way.
Of Stockholm syndrome.
Yeah.
But yeah, Stockholm syndrome isn't listed as a formal mental health diagnosis. So people who have this syndrome seem to have some other common symptoms though. So embarrassment about their emotions towards an abuser, confusion, guilt, difficulty trusting others, post-traumatic stress disorder, and after the abuse or being held captive, they might also have many other symptoms. So the ones I've just read were like the before symptoms, and now you've got fucking after symptoms. So denial, social withdrawal, chronic feelings of tension, feelings of emptiness, feelings of hopelessness, depression, anxiety, learned helplessness, excessive dependence, and loss of interest in activities. I suffer from many of those, but, you know, I don't have Stockholm syndrome.
I've had a few bosses that have made me feel like this. Maybe I had Stockholm syndrome when I was working for them.
Yeah,
maybe.
Yeah.
Getting back into daily life and adjusting after trauma can be difficult, and it can be hard for many of the victims to talk about their experiences, and it can re-traumatize them talking about it. So, yeah. That's pretty much it. So if you feel like you have Stockholm syndrome, or you know of someone who might,
or you're friends with me,
or you're friends with Amy, you should probably speak to a therapist. So yeah, therapy can help you recover from post-traumatic stress disorder, anxiety and depression, and it can also help you learn coping mechanisms to help you process the way you're feeling and help you regain some sense of normalness and understand your emotions and stuff. So
yeah, definitely don't come to any of us.
Don't come to us, but go.
We will probably say open a bottle of wine and lock that shit in a box, set that box on fire, and just have a drink and watch some random true crime doco, and you'll be fine. You'll be fine.
This is fine.
Yeah, probably not fine. Do that. But yeah.
So yeah, don't talk to us about it.
Yeah, definitely don't talk to Bianca. Fuck, have you fucking locking yourself away in a little room for eternity.
No, you just go about daily life. You just lock those thoughts in a box and set that box on fire. And you never think about it again until some random moment that you didn't really expect to.
Yeah, let's not do that and just seek professional help.
Yeah.
It
feels good.
So with that, I'll move on to my segment before I actually fall asleep myself. Colleen Stan,
Said I won't interrupt, okay?
Okay, you've already fucking interrupted. Let me try that one again. So, Colleen Stam was a 20-year-old from Eugene, Oregon in 1977 when she decided to hitchhike to a friend's home in Northern California. It was for a birthday party. I mean, fuck me. That was a long hike. I had a look on the map. That was a long fucking hike. She had stated that she was apparently an experienced hitchhiker, and she had declined two rides before accepting a ride from Cameron and Janice Hooker.
Oh, this is the Toy Story box, isn't it?
The girl in the box.
Oh. Toy Story box, toy box, whatever they call it.
No, it's just the girl in the box.
I know what this case is.
Yeah, but there was no Toy Story. What the fuck?
Not Toy Story. It's the toy box story.
Wasn't in a toy box, but okay. So she only felt comfortable getting into the van because Janice and their baby were in the car. They stopped off a gas station where Colleen used the bathroom, and she recalled that she had a feeling that she should jump out the window and, you know, run away and not fucking look back. But she pushed it aside and returned to the car. Mistake number one.
Dang, girl, gotta trust those gut feelings.
Yeah. So once they'd gotten to an isolated part of the highway, they pulled off and put a knife to her throat. And later, she was locked in a head box and then put in a bigger box. That was designed to block out all light.
Just making disgusted sounds over here.
Yeah, and fresh air. So
I've poured myself some more wine.
Why the hell would someone do this, you might
ask? I know!
Well, Cameron and Janice had reached an agreement stating that he could capture a slave to take Janice's place of being Cameron's bondage partner. Yeah, so apparently Janice wasn't into the whole being tortured thing.
Yeah.
She wasn't into the bondage. So, yeah, she let Cameron have his slave. But there was to be no penetrative sex, according to the agreement. But that was later changed.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So at first it was, you can beat her, but you can't fuck her.
That's right.
Right. Yeah. So it's just all torture.
Yeah. 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 So the first, when she was first kidnapped, she was strung up by her hands and physically attacked by Cameron. She was then left still hanging and blindfolded while Cameron and Janice had sex below her.
Hmm.
So the couple kept her locked in a box for 23 hours a day until she was given a contract and forced to sign it herself. And it signed her into slavery for life in January of 1978. So she was in there for months before they had given her this contract to sign. Cameron had also led her to believe that she was being watched by a powerful organization called The Company. It was a very, very clever name he came up with.
That's used a lot, I've noticed. Yeah.
Yeah. And they would torture her and her family if she tried to escape. So she did as she was told, and she started calling Cameron Master, and they referred to her as Kay. She was not allowed to speak without permission, and Cameron wanted her to be like the female character in some 1954 erotic novel, The Story of O.
Okay.
Yeah. So he's fucking read this novel and gone, oh, I want a woman like that. Yeah. So he soon started orally raping her, as he didn't want to break the contract that he made with his wife. So instead he raped her vaginally and anally with implements.
Ugh. I hate this story.
Yeah.
It's a horrible story, but I chose it, so I'm reading it. Yeah. After all that, the family actually moved to a mobile home in Red Bluff, taking Colleen with them, where she was kept locked in a wooden box under the couple's waterbed.
Yeah.
Janice even gave birth to the couple's second child on the bed while Colleen was trapped under it.
Oh, I didn't know that. Oh, my God. Yeah. No.
Fucking horrific.
It's fucked. So fucked, this story.
So that Colleen said her faith in God and her belief in a chance to escape helped her survive. But her biggest fear was the company, with Cameron reinforcing it daily. So she did what she was told. And this led to her being allowed out for jogs, some yard work, looking after the kids and helping build bigger accommodation like the underground dungeon for more slaves. Yeah. So even with all this newfound freedom, she never made an attempt to escape.
Yeah.
This is how bad her fear of this company, was.
She wouldn't know any better. I mean, there wasn't the internet, so.
Yeah.
Poor thing.
So at one point in 1981, she was captured in 1977. We're now in 1981.
Yeah.
She was even allowed to go home to visit her family unsupervised. He dropped her off. He came back. He picked her up. And then the next day they returned to the family home and Cameron came in and introduced himself as her boyfriend. And the family even took a photo of the happy smiling couple.
I can't.
Yeah.
Such a naive time.
But, like, surely I've listened to this a few times on a few different podcasts, and I'm like, surely when she comes in, you're like, where the fuck you been? Nope,
no, because they were afraid that she was going to disappear again.
They just don't ask questions. No.
So they noticed that, you know, she was a lot thinner, a lot paler. Her clothes were handmade. But yeah, they were scared that if they pushed for too much information, she would disappear again and they'd never see her. So they just took it easy.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, after that, Cameron felt like he'd given his slave too much freedom. And when they got back home, he locked her back in the box for 23 hours a day for the next 3 years.
God.
Yeah. She had a bedpan, which she moved with her feet to put it into position, and she was allowed to eat the scraps of food. The kids were told that Kay had gone home, and once the kids had gone to bed, she would then be allowed out of her box to eat her scraps and then to be tortured.
Yep.
She wasn't allowed to make any noise, and during the summer, didn't change. She was still trapped in the box under the bed 23 hours a day, where the box would reach temperatures over 38 degrees Celsius, so over 100 Fahrenheit.
Oh, God, could you imagine that? Just I can't sliding even that bedpan up, taking a shit, and then having to sit there in that hot box with your own shit. Oh, nah.
I couldn't handle
the poor girl.
Heat fucking at 30 degrees.
That Sarah, you can't handle 28.
I can't handle 24.
24 is nice, but anything above 25, you get just getting a little ridiculous. Oh. But yeah, so she was trapped in this box. Oh, it was horrible.
No. Oh,
she was reintroduced to the children and the neighbors in 1983 and then was allowed to get a job at a motel as a maid. You've gone from one extreme to another, mate. Fucking, she can't go anywhere for 3 years. Now she can have a job. Clearly, they fell on hard times. But he actually wanted her to become his second wife. And that was the turning point for Janice, who confessed that starting with their first date, she had also been tortured and brainwashed and was referred to as a whore over the years by her husband. She claimed she used denial and compartmentalization. Thank you. I tried to practice.
I mean, I'm not saying I use that, but I use that. Yeah.
I'm not saying that's my coping mechanism.
Well, she used it in order to survive their relationship.
You do.
Yeah. So in August of 1984, Janice went to Colleen and told her that Cameron was not part of the company. But she maintained that it did exist.
Okay. She may have believed it too.
She could have believed it.
But he wasn't part of it. Colleen went straight to the bus stop and called Cameron and said she was leaving him. And he replied by bursting into tears.
Ugh, pussy.
But she got on the bus and she went home to her family.
Yes.
So in the months after, she did not contact the police to report the heinous crimes. But she did continue to call Cameron.
Yeah.
Explaining later at the trial by saying that she wanted to give him and Janice a chance to reform. I mean, this was Janice's request. Don't call the police. Just give him a chance to, you know, better himself and blah, blah, blah. But 3 months later, Janice reported him to the police. She told him that he'd kidnapped and tortured and murdered Mary Elizabeth Spanhack, who disappeared on January 31st, 1976. So the year before Colleen was kidnapped. But they were unable to find her body due to the lack of physical proof. So no murder charge there was laid. Chris Hatcher, a forensic psychologist and criminal profile, testified for Cameron's prosecution at the start of the 1985 trial. And Janice testified against her husband in exchange for full immunity.
That's bullshit. Such bullshit.
So in the end, he was sentenced to consecutive life in prison, totaling 104 years for sexual assault, kidnapping, using a knife in the process. Originally Thank you. For parole until 2023. I really can't get my fucking mouth around these words.
You copy and paste it, mate.
Oh, I did copy and paste it.
You're nearly there, mate. Come on.
I'm nearly here.
You're nearly there. Come on.
He had his hearing date moved up several years to 2015 by California Elderly Parole Program. On April 16th, 2015, his request for parole was denied. And he will be eligible for another hearing in 2030. However, due to the COVID pandemic, California officials contacted Colleen and advised her that they were looking into possibly granting Cameron parole in March 2021.
What?
Yeah. Instead of a parole hearing, authorities scheduled a hearing in September of 2021.
Right now.
Like right now.
Yeah, to decide if he should be classified as a sexually violent predator. Well, fucking yes, clearly. Yes. Which would result in a civil commitment to the state hospital.
Okay.
It was, in fact, pushed back to October. So next month. We don't know what's going to happen there.
It's just so much nope to that. Yeah. There's just so much nope.
I just can't. 104 years, but what? They want to let him out because there's a pandemic. Oh, fuck off. Well, they're hoping he's going to get COVID.
He's an old man now.
I don't care.
He's still got a working brain and a working mouth. He still has the ability to influence other people around him. You're talking about someone who's not just a violent sexual predator, but he's also somebody who can use all sorts of emotional blackmail and everything else to coerce his victims. So
I'm all for him actually just being killed. I am somewhat pro death penalty in certain circumstances.
Somewhat.
Well, that's just who I am. In 2016, a TV movie was released based on the case called Girl in the Box. And the main point for an American documentary-style horror film, Plow Keepsie?
Keepsie.
Keepsie Tape. In 2007 was based on this case. So after the trial, Colleen studied for an accounting degree. And just try to move on and live a normal life.
Good on you, Colleen.
Yeah, it didn't quite work out that way, but I'm not going to go into that because that's not a part of this case.
Okay.
And that's me done. Good night, Baltimore.
Good night.
So, Amy.
Yeah.
What have we got?
Amy.
I am going
Let's to... Let's just keep lightening this mood, hey?
I am going to regale you with the story of Patty Hearst. Just a heads up, mine's a long one, so strap in. Take a chug of wine. That's what I'm doing right now.
Sorry, I'm muting myself now. Go for it.
Okay. I've taken a chug. Here we go. Born Patricia Campbell Hearst in 1954 in San Francisco, known as Patty but preferred to be called Patricia, she was the granddaughter of an American publishing magnate, William Randolph Hearst. She became known for the events that followed her kidnapping in 1974 by the Symbionese Liberation Army. She was found and arrested 19 months after being abducted. Why on earth was she arrested if she was the victim of an abduction, you say? Well, yeah. Only in America. No, that's not true. Anyway, I'll keep going. The prosecution in the case argued that she was wanted for several serious crimes committed by the group who kidnapped her, but she became a willing participant somewhere along the line. Patricia, on the other hand, argued that, she'd been raped and threatened with death while being held captive, so she just was going along with whatever kept her alive. Yeah, so let's have a look at how all of this went down. Patricia is the granddaughter of William Randolph Hearst. He created the largest newspaper, magazine, newsreel, and movie business in the world. She was the third of five daughters of Randolph Apperson Hearst and Catherine Wood Campbell. All these people kept both their parents' names, so I can only...
That's a very English thing to do, too.
I was going to say they're obviously, like, people who have got some sort of wealth or something.
Yeah.
Most
of the time it is. I don't know many unwealthy people that would go, yes, I'm Rupert Campbell Black.
The fourth. Yeah. Lord Roderick Cumberbund. I was going to go longer, but not. Anyway, you've got the point. Yeah. It, obviously well-to-do kind of people. She attended some fairly swanky private schools growing up and attended the University of California in Berkeley. And she was studying.
She's
a Berkeley girl. Yeah, well, it's the University of California in Berkeley. So
it wasn't Berkeley.
No. Yeah. So she was studying art history at the time of the kidnapping. Oh, she was living in an apartment.
For away money.
Yeah, I know. Well, what's the point? She's already like an heiress. Why aren't she? True. Like, what's the point?
Yeah, she may as well have thrown in like philosophy or dancing or dance, interpretive.
Interpretive dance. Yeah. Definitely.
Mm.
Yeah. So she was living in an apartment that she shared with her fiancé at the time of the kidnapping. Now, Patricia's father was one of the many heirs to his father's fortune, so the Hearst family fortune, and he didn't have control of the family interest. So Patricia's mother and father did not necessarily consider it something that they had to do in terms of taking out security measures for their children or themselves. So they're ridiculously rich because they're looked after, obviously, by this family fortune, but they don't have control of it. So they figure, well, do we need like private security? Nah.
We would do the same. We're like, well, we don't have access, so it makes no sense to like hire private security.
However, we are also kids who went to a ghetto school, so fight me.
Yeah.
I dare you. Come at me, see what happens. Yeah.
Oh, shit in my hand and throw it at you. Don't test me. Yeah.
And I can do this in 3 seconds.
Yeah.
Time. I'm ready.
Ghetto raised, bitch.
Yeah, Patricia was not like raised in that sort of situation. No, I don't think she'd know what to do with herself. So, yeah, a bit different. Anyway, on the 4th of February 1974, Patricia, who was 19 at the time, was kidnapped from her apartment by the Symbionese Liberation Army, so the SLA, and they claimed responsibility for the abduction straight away. So, why did they kidnap Patricia? Hearst's kidnapping was partly opportunistic as she happened to live nearby the SLA hideout. According to the testimony at trial, the group's main intention was to leverage Patricia's family's political influence to free two SLA members who were arrested for murder.
Okay.
Yeah. Faced with the failure to free the imprisoned men, so what that means is the police said no. Release her and we'll release our men and we'll release her. And the police went, no, it's not happening.
Yeah.
So they changed tax, and the SLA demanded that the captive's family distribute $70 worth of food to every needy Californian, an operation that would cost an estimated $400 million.
Wow.
In response, Patricia's father took out a loan, and he arranged the immediate donation of $2 million worth of food to the poor of the Bay Area in an operation called People in Need. So he took out a loan for $2 million. I don't know that they were really that wealthy. They keep banging on about, like when I was reading about this, keep banging on how rich these people were. I don't know who they were, though.
Some people look a lot more rich than what they actually are. Because, I mean, like, they're on paper, they might look rich, but liquid assets, nothing.
Clearly, because, well, he had to go get a loan. Yeah. But then again, he managed to get a loan for $2 million. I don't think a bank would ever give me that sort of money. And rightly so. That would be
enough. Yes. Nobody should give us that money.
Have I mentioned buy me a coffee? Anyway, so after the distribution descended into chaos, because people went a bit crazy, the SLA refused to release Patricia. So what was Patricia's side of this? According to Patricia's testimony, she was held for a week in a closet, blindfolded, with her hands tied, during which time an SLA founder and leader, his name was Sneak, but his actual name was Donald DeFries, repeatedly threatened her with death. She was let out for meals, but she was still blindfolded at the time and subsequently began to join in the political discussions. She was given a flashlight for reading, and she was also given SLA political propaganda to memorize.
I would have loved that.
Yeah, I probably would have got involved in the political conversations as well, just because I probably couldn't handle the stupid anymore, and my mouth would start moving and my brain would be like, shut up. Yeah.
For funsies. I mean, what else are you going to do? You're trapped in the closet. Oh, I'll memorize it.
Yeah.
I agree with all these points, but could we get the Flying Spaghetti Monster on site? Thank you.
And would you like, and if this was you, Bianca, I'd be like, would you like to see all your grammatical mistakes? I've circled them. Yeah. And I'm going to explain to you why you've got this wrong. Anyway, so after that, Patricia was confined in a closet for weeks, after which she said that DeFries told me that the War Council had decided or was thinking about killing me or letting me stay with them. And I better start thinking about that as a possibility. So Patricia then said that she accommodated my thoughts to coincide with theirs. But then again, in a different account, she said that she'd been offered the choice to be released or joining the SLA. So there's a few there's a few different things here, but anyway, there's a lot with this case. I'm just going to go over it very briefly. When asked for her decision, Patricia said that she wanted to stay and fight with the SLA. The blindfold was removed and it was allowing to see her captors for the first time. After this, she was given daily lessons on her duties and especially with weapons drills. A prominent female member of the SLA told Patricia that the others thought she should know what sexual freedom was like in the unit. She was allegedly raped by two members of the SLA. So on the 3rd of April 1974, 2 months after she was abducted, Patricia announced on an audio tape that she had joined the SLA and taken the name Tanya. Patricia was then was in deep with some shady shit that the SLA had done. There was a bank robbery where there was reports that she had a gun, and there was reports from some of the people that were at the bank at the time saying that she was holding a gun. But then there was other reports saying that she was holding a gun, but other members of the SLA were pointing guns at her during the robbery. So it's a bit hard. Plus, all these people were, you know, in a fair bit of distress being robbed from the bank.
They're a bit traumy.
They're a bit traumy. So it's not exactly the best recount. There was an incident where a member of the SLA was chased by a store manager who witnessed the member steal something. Patricia allegedly got out of the van where she was waiting for the other members and used an automatic weapon to shoot up at the overhead storefront, causing the manager to retreat. So the SLA member was running towards the van. She got out of the van with her AK-47 or whatever it was, some automatic weapon, and didn't shoot the manager. She just shot up the top of the storefront.
Like, she didn't shoot the manager, she shot the deputy.
That's terrible.
I'm so sorry.
You should be ashamed of yourself for that.
Hey, Sarah Soy.
Ashamed.
I had to.
Hey, so he wasn't hurt. So it was just, it was more of a fuck off fire round. That's what that was. Anyway. Yeah. She was also involved in a carjacking where a few carjackings, actually, where victims who were taken hostage actually testified that she was so personable, it was really hard to report her. And she was always asking if they were okay. So it was just, it was hard for them to testify against her because she was so nice. Yes, which fits into everything Sarah discussed earlier. However, it was also alleged that she assisted the SLA in making explosive devices. The police actually thought at one stage she died in a shootout with police and other SLA members, but she actually was not one of the deceased. Once the smoke cleared and they went and had a look at the bodies, she wasn't there. So they realised, oh, okay. Another major crime that she was involved in was the murder of a woman making a bank deposit. She was driving the getaway car when the victim was shot and killed by a member of the SLA, meaning that she was at risk of having a felony murder charge laid on her because driving a getaway car is still... Yes and no. You're effect- if you assist in the murder of somebody, then you can be held just as accountable as the person who actually killed the person.
Yeah, yeah.
And most Western countries work like that in some way, shape or form. Anyway, so Patricia was arrested in 1975 in San Francisco. After she was charged, she listed her occupation as, I love this, urban gorilla, and asked...
Same, right? But that's mainly because I stopped shaving.
And I think urban caveman's a good one for me.
Yeah.
A burbs. Burbs cave bitch. Anyway, she asked her attorney to relay this message. Tell everybody that I'm smiling and that I feel free and strong, and I send my greetings and love to all my sisters and brothers out there. At the time of her arrest, Hearst's weight had dropped to 87 pounds. So that's about 40 kilos. I'm pretty sure my thumb weighs that. So, yeah.
Jesus.
Yeah, she's tiny. She was also described by a psychologist in October 1975 as having a low IQ, or someone who can be described as a low effect zombie. Oh, okay. So she was fucked. Yeah, she's fucked. Shortly after her arrest, signs of trauma were recorded. Her IQ was actually measured as 112, whereas previously it had been measured at 130. So she was smart. Before she got in there, she was smart.
Yeah.
There are huge gaps in her memory regarding her pre-Tanya life, and she was smoking heavily and reported having nightmares. Without a mental illness or defect, a person is considered to be fully responsible for any criminal action not done under duress, which is defined as clear and present threat of death or serious injury. For Patricia to secure an acquittal on the grounds of being brainwashed, it would have been completely unprecedented at the time. So that wasn't a thing at all in the 70s. Could not claim you were brainwashed, which I kind of understand. She was interviewed by psychiatrists at length, and many said that she met the criteria of a coerced prisoner of war. Patricia's first lawyer decided that the brainwashing defense was not a legal defense and tried to argue that the SLA drugged her and that affected her judgment and recollection. Of course, a jury's going to see right through that. That's insane. Yeah. You're not going to let somebody who's so drugged out of their brain that they can't make decisions for themselves go and commit like robberies with you with guns.
Yeah. But you can't let them be. Them. You definitely wouldn't fill someone up with drugs and then go, the keys. Now you're gonna drive the car. Nope. Not gonna happen.
Here's a gun. We're gonna go and rob a bank. You in? Yeah, that's not happening. Let's
not forget it.
If someone's on drugs, you would hand them a banana and say, this is a gun, we're going to go rob a bank.
But that's now. Don't forget, this was in the 70s.
Yeah, I don't know. I still think that, yeah, any jury would have seen through this. Anyway, Patricia's second lawyer actually asserted a defense of coercion or distress affecting intent to commit the crimes that were alleged against her. Now, this is similar to a brainwashing defense that the first lawyer said was not a thing, but this actually is a thing. The defense of coercion or duress, that is a thing. I'm not sure why he didn't decide to argue this in the first place. Anyway, so Patricia repudiated her ties with the SLA during her trial. But put simply, the trial didn't go well, and neither did the appeals. She was given the maximum sentence of 35 years, and by this time, everyone knew the case.
Yeah.
Actor John Wayne even commented that people accepted that the Jonestown victims were brainwashed. It was like 900 odd people that died out of Jonestown. Yeah. People just accepted that they were brainwashed, but they wouldn't accept the fact that Patricia Hearst was. Why? How is it not the same? So yeah, that was interesting. It had sort of drawn a lot of interest from a lot of different people. In the end, President Jimmy Carter commuted her sentence to 22 months served, and she was released on the 1st of February 1979. Bill Clinton actually granted her a full pardon on the 20th of January 2001, which was his last day in office. You know that thing they can do where they can just let people out of jail because fun and like give them full pardons on like sketchy shit they did? Yeah, Bill Clinton gave that to Patty Hearst. I've got a picture of Patricia Hearst at the top of my segment. Have a guess why Bill Clinton might have given her a pardon. Just guess. Just guess. Have a guess. Anyway, since her release, she has actually written books and appeared in movies, and one is actually one of Sarah's faves called Crybaby, and she was Maggie Woodard. You know how I said when we did that segment and Sarah was reading out the cast and she goes, "And Patty Hearst?" I went, "This is the same Patty Hearst?" She's like, "I don't know." Yeah, it turns out there it was. So, yay. Yeah, got that one. And also, she is in one of our collective faves, which is Biodome, and she plays herself.
No, that was me. That was me, Son of a Beach.
No, she's in Crybaby.
Yeah, and I said she was the Son of a Beach, and you said, "Oh, is that the same Patty Hearst, like the Patty Hearst?"
Oh,
I
was
like,
okay. Yeah, she's in Crybaby. I feel like I mentioned it then too.
Yeah, it is, because I hadn't looked into it. Yep, totally was. No, it is.
This is what happens, people, when you do a podcast about stuff that you dug up from your brain and you're drinking at the same time.
Yeah.
Tend to have the same conversations with several different people, so yeah, it's fun. Yeah. Anyway, so that's my segment done. Bianca, what have you got for us?
I am going to talk about Mary McElroy. So on the evening of May 27th, 1933, 25-year-old Mary McElroy was taking a bubble bath in her father's house when she was abducted by four men. Two of those men were brothers George and Walter McGee. The men had broken into the house with a sawed-off shotgun. They then waited for Mary to get dressed before taking her to an old farmhouse and chaining her to a wall in the basement. Mary was the daughter of Kansas City manager, and his name is Henry F. McElroy. He was a potential gold mine in ransom money. He's the city manager, for fuck's sake. So they realized this, and the men demanded $60,000 for Mary's release. But apparently Henry said no. And they said, okay, $50,000 and two sheep. And he said, no.
I'll give you $350,000.
Yeah. And, yeah, they settled for $30,000. I am actually, that's not really what they haggled, but they did haggle. And I'm shocked that he haggled for his daughter's life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I watched that one about that billionaire in Europe whose grandson got taken. He had his ear cut off and stuff like that. And, yeah, you'd be surprised. People are cunts. They'll haggle. They don't care.
Yeah, well, he did. And so, anyway, they settled for, $30,000 in the end. And we went down to half. Like, he fucking, yeah, he was really onto them. So the sum, that $30,000, was paid on May 29th, 1933, and Mary was released unharmed. She was released near Melbourne Golf. The three of the men were captured less than a month later and sent to trial. However, Mary said that she was well cared for during 29 hours in captivity. Apparently, one of the men even gave her flowers to make her feel better because she was crying. So he went and got her flowers, like, "Oh my God, I'm so sorry." Like, they, all they wanted was money. They were, they didn't actually want to hurt her. Like, they chained her to the wall, but they didn't really want to hurt her. So, yeah, they actually, there was flowers, there was chocolates. They talked to her like she was a normal person. And that was one of the things I think she, a lot of what I've read, she didn't have a lot of that in her personal life, like where people respected her because of who her dad was. Like, she's just that girl and her dad's, you know, the big guy. And, yeah, they were actually talking to her like she was a normal person. And, yes, so when the trial concluded, all three men were giving harsh sentences. Mary was actually just completely riddled with guilt. She publicly sympathised with her abductors and called upon Governor Guy Brashfield Park to reverse the sentence. Mary remained friends with the McGee brothers throughout their incarceration. She visited them often in prison and she brought them gifts. The whole ordeal of them being in prison led to multiple nervous breakdowns for Mary. And after her father died in 1939, Mary's mental state just collapsed. And on January 21st, 1940, she committed suicide. So the worst part is part of her suicide note, I'm not going to read all of it, I'll just read the part that's pertinent to the case. "My four kidnappers are probably the four people on earth who don't consider me an utter fool."
Oh, that's sad.
Yeah, and then the line after that is, "You have your death sentence." And, yeah, like, because that's what they're up for, their death sentence. So
seriously?
So her death, then they decided they weren't going to kill the kidnappers, so they didn't.
Wow.
Yeah. "You have your death sentence." It's just crazy. That's what I mean. Like, I think is an absolute perfect example of Stockholm Syndrome for that reason.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
See, Patty Hearst flipped it on its head in the end. And I don't know whether it was because her lawyers told her that she was better off renouncing it all and not saying anything about this, because Stockholm Syndrome is not recognised. It's still not recognised. So what good would it do to turn around and sympathise with captors? Nothing. But in this case, it clearly did, because it saved those men from their sentence. Although they deserved it. That was the law at the time. I mean, harsh, but...
Yeah, it was the law at the time. But, yes, Patty Hearst and Mary, they grew up in very similar circumstances, families with money.
Or the appearance of money.
Appearance of money, yes. Yeah, well, that could have been the thing too. That might have been why he turned down $60,000 and went all the way down to $30,000. It could have been.
I don't have that money.
Yeah. But, yes, it's just really sad.
Yeah. This topic was a downer, guys.
It really was. I mean, I tried to do quiz some quick quips in there, but no.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying it was a downer, because these people that are victims in these stories don't deserve our time or anything like that. However, it was a bit darker than what we're used to. I'm going to put that out there. A little bit darker than what we're used to. So, yes, but still.
I was really keen to do this topic, though, like, as a difference for our other ones, which are generally very lighthearted. But we have some lighthearted ones coming. Oh, yes, you wait.
That's great.
Yeah.
There is the utter ridiculousness coming back, guys. Just strap in. It's okay. Yeah. It's coming. Yeah.
So I had so much fun researching this topic, as I did with the other topics of the last few weeks. However, we would love some topic suggestions from your listeners. If you have a topic which you would like us to discuss, please hit us up on our socials or at fridaynightwifi@gmail.com. And to everyone who has listened to this, we would like to thank each and every one of you for your time in listening to our rubbish. We hope that you have found it entertaining and are not using any of the facts discussed in this recording to make important decisions in your lives.
Unless it's to go see a therapist.
Or to become like a Burbs K bitch. BCB. Yeah. Wholeheartedly go for him.
Yeah, just maybe don't take captives and lock them in boxes, because that's fucking terrifying.
Definitely go get a therapist.
Yeah, get a therapist.
Yeah, definitely get a therapist and not a bottle of wine, like a
or a box or a with box. A slave in it. Yeah. Gross.
All right, guys. Peace out. Bye.
Bye.